These are African rhythms, passed down to us through ancient spirits. Feel the spirit, a unifying force. Come on, move with the spirit.
From WSNC 90.5 FM, a broadcasting service, an NPR affiliate of Winston-Salem State University, welcome to Africa World Now Project. I'm your host and producer, James Pope. Today, we will hear Sylvia Federici, author of Caliban and the Witch, Women, the Body, and Primitive Accumulation, explore her new works, Witches, Witch Hunting, and Women, as well as Reenchanting the World, Feminism, and the Politics of the Commons. Africa World Now Project is next. The relationship between the rise of capitalism, the exploitation of labor and natural resources, the control of the productive forces are important components of interest when attempting to understand the imposition of the negatively constructed socio-political and cultural institutions of the West. The contradictions that move capitalist societies have been subjects of those who study and try to organize folk who are caught within the fissures and cavities of the eventual conflicts that arise from capitalism. According to the article Repression and Resistance on the Terrain of Social Reproduction, Historical Trajectories, Contemporary Openings, while the idea of social reproduction is most often associated with Marxist feminist literature from the 1970s, considerable work has been done around the concept in a wide range of bodies of work throughout the 1960s and the 70s. In the 1970s, Marxist feminists in Western Europe as well as the United States identified social reproduction as a field of productive, generative activity. For them, patriarchal relationships and the subordination of women in the home appeared as a precondition to capitalist exploitation. What stood for labor, namely wage and industrial production, was a product of a white, male, political imaginary unable to account for the work of social reproduction relegated to the home, the private, and other spheres outside the factory. The work of domestic labor, biological reproduction, and the reproduction of labor power were all ignored by the traditional Marxist accounts, which confined their notion of labor to the factory. In other words, the critique of the capital-labor relationship excluded the sphere of the home and the domestic, where women were responsible for all the work of the reproduction of labor power through domestic work, and for the reproduction of the working class more generally by bearing and caring for children. It is here Sylvia Federici's work, particularly in Caliban and the Witch, Women, the Body, and Primitive Accumulation, comes in to argue against Marx. For Federici, primitive accumulation is not a necessary precursor for capitalism, but rather that primitive accumulation is a fundamental characteristic of capitalism itself. That capitalism, in order to perpetuate itself, requires a continuous transfusion of capital expropriation. She connects this expropriation to women's unpaid labor and reproductive labor as a historical precondition to the rise of a capitalist economy predicated upon wage labor. The historical fight for the commons and the struggle for communalism, instead of seeing capitalism as being a liberatory defeat of feudalism, Federici interprets the rise of capitalism as a reactionary move to subvert the rising tide of communalism and to retain the basic social contract. Capitalism was a strategy devised in reaction to a time of unprecedented workers' power and mass uprisings against the elite. She places the institutionalization of rape and prostitution, as well as the heretic and witch hunting, trials, burnings, and torture at the center of a methodological subjugation of women and the appropriation of their labor. While this work is important, it must not, it cannot be lost that the work of African and African-descended women from Maria Stuart, Sojourner Truth, to Claudia Jones, and the proper expansion of capitalism to be contextualized as racial capitalism preceded these notions. And once contextualized, we see the limits of the aforementioned critiques. Again, we return to the article, Repression and Resistance, on the Terrain of Social Reproduction, Historical Trajectories, Contemporary Openings, who offers a perspective that suggests Marxist and socialist feminists concerned with issues of reproduction and domestic labor for the most part did not acknowledge prior legacies of women of color organizing around issues of social reproduction and in particular housing and welfare. drawing genealogies of social reproduction from the perspective of black women's experiences pre- and post-slavery to the racist politics of the welfare regimes, Africana women demonstrated that the domestic confines of the housewife was the problem of white, working, and middle-class women. Many of these ideas were first articulated in Claudia Jones's important 1949 essay, To End the Neglect of the Problems of the Negro Woman. It is here Jones introduced the idea of the triplet oppression of working-class black women. She showed that having had to work alongside their men, black women were never confined to the domestic sphere alone. From here, writing in the 1970s and early 1980s, black women such as, but not limited to, Angela Davis and Hazel Carby continued the line of thought articulated by Jones. In partial response to wages for housework, Angela Davis wrote that throughout this country's history, black women toiled together with men under the whip of plantation overseers, suffering a brutal sexual equality at work. Dr. Davis continues, after slavery, black women were employed in vast numbers in a range of industries from tobacco and sugar to lumber and steel. It is here that Professor Davis shows how black women's labor was mobilized in the reproductive realm as well as in the manufacturing and service industries long before discourses of the double burden emerged in white feminist thought. Today, Sylvia Federici will revisit the ideas she presented in Caliban and the Witch through her new works titled Witches, Witch Hunting, and Women, and Reenchanting the World, Feminist and the Politics of the Commons. Sylvia Federici is an Italian-American activist and author of many works, including Caliban and the Witch and The Revolution at Point Zero, Housework, Reproduction, and Feminist Struggle. She was co-founder of the International Feminist Collective and organizer with the Wages for Housework campaign and was involved in the Midnight Notes Collective. Sylvia Federici has taught at several universities in the U.S. and in also Nigeria. She is now Professor Emerita at Hofstra University. Our show is produced today in solidarity with the Native, Indigenous, African, and Afro-descended communities at Standing Rock, Venezuela, Corporation Jackson in Jackson, Mississippi, Brazil, the Avalon Village in Detroit, Colombia, Kenya, Palestine, South Africa, and Ghana, and other places who are fighting for the protection of our land for the benefit of all peoples. Enjoy the program.
So please join me in welcoming Sylvia Federici.
Good evening to you all, and I'm trying to find a way that I can see you all, but that's, I'm not sure. Let's see, maybe this way? Yeah? Okay, sounds pretty good. And first, thank you to the Potter House for inviting me here. You know, it's I haven't been actually in Washington for many, many, many years. It's been a pleasure to be back. So I'm actually introducing tonight two books, which is The Witch Hunting, Witches and Women, and Enchanting the World. So I will talk about both a bit together because in a way these two books are connected. They all discuss, analyze new forms of capitalist accumulation, the violence that they produce, the displacement in people's life, but also and particularly reenchanting the world. The forms of resistance, the forms, the way in which people are defending their community, and also in the process, creating new social relations, creating new forms of reproduction, and sowing the seeds for what I think is a society to come. So, briefly, schematically, because I'm really interested in having time to discuss with you, to hear what you think about this work and what kind of struggles you're involved in, I want to talk about the content of the two books. Witch Hunting, Witches and Women, in a sense, continue some of the work of Caliban and the Witch, but at the same time updates it. You know, it has a first part that looks more deeply on some issues in the witch hunts of the 16th, 17th century, in particular the relationship between witch hunting and enclosure. You know, the process of enclosure, the process of land dispossession, And this was a theme that I kept finding. It was not, certainly for those of you who have read Caliban and the Witch, you know that this is not, land dispossession was not the only factor that was connected with the persecution against women in the 16th, 17th century, but certainly was an important one, and one that I've been more interested in investigating. So this is part of the work that I'm doing, and I certainly hope that in doing this work, I'm also inspiring, you know, other people to continue it, because I believe that first, there's a lot more to learn about the witch hunts that have taken place in Europe, in the United States, not just in Salem, but also in particular also in Latin America, because witch hunting was exported, brought by the missionaries, by the conquistadores, first in the south of the American continent, and then practically in every country that they colonized. But certainly in countries like Mexico, Brazil, Colombia, you know, you really have, it was a massive, massive process of, massive attack, particularly on women, through the accused, the charge of witchcraft. So I'm looking at the issue of enclosure, I'm looking about how dispossession, land displacement, was a factor in the witch hunt. I'm also looking in part one at why, you know, this very strange phenomenon that women that for all, you know, by all criteria were powerless or had very limited power. Many of them were proletarian women, peasant women, inspired so much fear. Has to, lead to such ferocious attack and such atrocious forms of punishment. So what was the fear that these women inspired? Yeah, this is something that I explore in the first part of the book. And in this first part, I also look at the changes that have taken place in the concept, the term gossip. Because I discovered, studying the 16th, 17th, 18th century, studying all that period of primitive accumulation, I discovered that the original significance, meaning of gossip, was friend. You know, you would say, I went out with my gossip, right? It meant a very close female friend. And as we know, of course, what gossip means today, right? It's a very derogatory, negative term. And what happened, and I discovered, and not accidentally, the change in the term takes place precisely in the 2-3 centuries that we now associate with the development of capitalism, right? And so clearly the change of the term, it's part of this war that was waged against women with so many legislation, but also with the witch hunt themselves. And it's very interesting also, because I think that the change in the term also expresses how, you know, the persecution of the witches was an attack in particular on all forms of female organization, female solidarity. Right, because with the notion of gossip, the giving of the derogatory term, derogatory meaning, right, to a term indicating friendship and indicating, an effective relationship among women, right, you basically, discourage this kind of relationship. And this, of course, was not an isolated phenomenon, because in the very same period in which the change was taking place, you also have legislation, for example, all new practices, new preached from the pulpit of the churches or by the politicians that discourage women to consult with other women, discourage them, for example, from sitting in front of the house or going, you know, passing time, you know, with their friends, so that every coming together of women begins to be suspicious, begins to be seen as something demonic, as something that is antisocial, ironically, antisocial, right? And so this looking at the change in the concept of gossip is actually a small window into a much, much broader process. But what I'm really interested most in this book, it's really the updating of the theme of the witch hunt into the present. Because witch hunting has not ended, quite the contrary. And it has not ended in this very literal way, because we have still persecution of women accused of being witches. And in the broader sense that over the last decade, we have seen a global upsurge of violence against women, violence of all type, from domestic violence to public violence of paramilitary army to institutional violence, because much of the legislation, beginning with this one country, much of this legislation that has been passed, social legislation that has been passed that affects women, has been very violent, and is something that not all of it is understood in its consequences and in its magnitude. So this is what the second part of Witch Hunting and Witches attempts to do. And it looks in particular at the new witch hunts that are taking place in Africa, in India, Papua New Guinea, no? But with a special focus on Africa, where starting with the 1980s, very much hand in hand with the expansion of capitalist relation in the continent, the debt crisis, the process of structural adjustment, the World Bank increasing attack on communitarian relation, on communitarian land regimes. You have, an increasing number of accusation of women, the return of accusation of women, that are blamed for everything happening, disaster and death or illness that takes place in the community. And there are clearly many factors involved. One in particular is the expansion in the same years, together with the process of globalization, together with this new economic war, which is a process of recolonization. With this new economic war, we have the expansion of Pentecostal evangelical sects throughout the African continent, as well as in Latin America and other regions of the world, right, who are bringing again a kind of religion that speaks of the fact that Satan is conspiring, Satan is active in the world, and if people are poor, they have to look at what is happening in their community, because perhaps there are some who are conspiring against them. So it's an initiative that sows suspicion in communities that, as in the 17th century, were facing a tremendous social, political, and economic attack. And with these new accusations and with the propagation of this new kind of new version of Calvinist religion, you actually weaken a community that, in a moment in which it should be most united, but in reality you weaken it by sowing suspicion, and many of the mishaps and are produced by evil people, and of course women are more prominent among them. So the article that is at the center of part two really tries to again look at the connection between this new phenomenon, this return, unexpected, you know, unimaginable. When I was working on Caliban and the Witch, never, you know, and this was the, from the 70s, the 80s, never I would have thought that the very soon I would learn about witch hunt, you know, in my own time, of witch hunt, you know, in the present. Never I thought that I would see that. And of course, I imagined also, I imagined that if there were, had been, or were witch hunt today, there would be an immense uproar. Actually, there hasn't been. There hasn't been. Women have been buried alive. Women have been burned to death, you know, in the, or cut to pieces by machete, and that there hasn't been the kind of approval that I would have expected. And so I'm trying to look at what are the connections, you know, between the return of witch hunting and the new forms of capitalist accumulation. And once again, there are very clear connection with the land dispossession and the general devaluation of women, and particularly old women. The war that the World Bank is making on women, there is a war the World Bank is making, you know, this World Bank that is based here in Washington. In fact, at one point they say, like, the struggle against witch hunting must be brought to the doorstep of the World Bank. So this is one of the places where we actually have to make people accountable. Because the World Bank, for instance, has been really waging a war, a political war against women across the world, in the sense that first in the 90s has accused women, for example, in Africa, of being the cause of poverty. By, you know, with the argument that if there's poverty in the third world, it's because women have too many children, right? So the World Bank has been one of the big promoters of the idea that actually the impoverishment that continues in the third world despite the big anti-colonial struggle is due to the fact that the women, these senseless creatures, are actually producing so many children. And by that, they're making their community, you know, economically miserable. And then, you know, phase two has been accusing women of bringing poverty into their community because they insist, especially in Africa, to work, you know, engage themselves in subsistence agriculture. And one of the missions, of the historic missions of the World Bank, is really to put an end to every form of subsistence agriculture. You know, they have embraced this economic belief that was promoted initially by a Latin American economist, Hernán Soto, and who proclaimed that you know, land is not fertile, that we have to begin to understand that it's not land that is creative and is productive of new forms of life, but money is. That the productive part of economic activity is money, not land. And so if you have land, you'll be fooled, according to Soto, you'll be fooled, and according to the World Bank now, who has embraced the same philosophy, you would be fooled to use it to support yourself, to, for example, feed yourself or use it for other subsistence purposes. What you should do, if you have land, go to the bank, use it as a collateral, right? And with that money that you, the loan that you gain, you know, set up a little business. And that's like the whole story of microcredit and so on, which in fact has served to create a whole population of women completely indebted, right? So I make a lot of connections in this article by going, trying to actually see where does this new persecution come from, where it connects with land dispossession, where it connects with the devaluation, for example, of the whole female economy, particularly subsistence economy. And there's also other factors that seem to be very important. You know, for instance, women's trader, women who are trading at the local level, in the local market, have been accused of being witches by traders, mostly male, who are involved in import-export business and who see them as competitor. There is also evidence, and this at least the claim that has been made, that the sowing of suspicion is particularly effective because, you know, with the process of globalization, you know, a situation has emerged whereby in many parts of the world, particularly the rural parts of the world, right, people less and less understand what are the forces that are shaping their life. Because the decisions that are shaping their life are so removed. They are taken in Washington, they are taken in London, they are taken in New York. And so the fact that the price of coffee, for example, collapses, the fact that they cannot sell any longer whatever product they used to sell in the past because the kind of selling and buying boards at the government level have been destroyed because of structural adjustment. In other words, there's been, with globalization, there's been a whole new economic arrangement, set of arrangements, that has made it very difficult for people to understand what is really taking place. You know, and so that these two contribute to the sense of unsettlement and that to the ease with which suspicion can be generated. So I also look at the broader issue of the surge of violence against women, which is not only taking the form of witch hunting is a very important one, but goes beyond witch hunting. For example, throughout Latin America in the last 10-15 years, you know, we have seen an enormous increase in the number of women, particularly women who are involved in the land struggle or in defense of their territory, particularly women who have been leaders. We all know Berta Cáceres. She had been given a prize here by the Inter-American Commission before she was killed in Honduras. She was given a prize here. In fact, her daughter was just here last week in Washington. But so clearly, the murder of so many women at the hand of narcotraffickers, at the hand of paramilitary, which is also a new phenomenon, is connected to the struggle that women are making, you know, in defense of the land, against mining company, against oil drilling, against a whole range of mega projects, you know, hydroelectric plant, highway. Now highways are being constructed everywhere. Because with globalization, there's these huge movements of commodities across the world. So territories have to be devastated to create places that the commodities can move, can go to the port, can be exported. You know, Eduardo Galeano, the Uruguayan writer that died a few years ago, spoke of the open veins of Latin America, right? The open veins of Latin America. Latin America, the blood of Latin America is being sucked away. And well, you can see it physically when you travel in many parts of Latin America. You see physically on the road this big lineup of trucks, roads that have been turned completely into trucks, one long truck taking things away, exporting work, exporting life, exporting product. So there's all this violence because, in fact, there is a major struggle in which women have a prominent role.
You are currently listening to Silvia Federici, revisit the ideas that she presented in her previous work, Caliban and the Witch, through exploring her new works titled Witches, Witch Hunting, and Women, Reenchanting the World, Feminism, and the Politics of the Commons. Sylvia Federici is an Italian-American activist and author of many works, including Caliban and the Witch and Revolution at Point Zero, Housework, Reproduction, and Feminist Struggle. She has taught in various universities in the U.S. and Nigeria, and is now a professor emerita at Hofstra University. Please continue to enjoy the program.
Struggle against extractivism. And so they become the target. They become the target of a lot of paramilitary violence. And also an argument has been made, and here I want to mention the work of the well-known feminist sociologist Rita Segato, who is a Brazilian, actually Argentinian, but she's now in Brazil, who has made the argument that attacking women is the most effective way to force a community to be displaced. So that if a mining company comes, and as often is the case, they say to the community, you guys have to got to go. They come with the engineers, they come with the army, and they say you got to go because we're going to drill here, because there's been some deal made, the oil has to be extracted, or gold, for instance. Then if there's resistance, the killing of women is the most effective because quick women are the ones who are keeping the community together. Women are the ones who do the ends, will find ways to keep the community together even in the face of many adversities. And also, they are associated with life, with the production of life, with often they are seen, they are not combatants, they are less likely to carry arms. So the killing of women has a special message that do not attempt to resist because you're facing people who know no limit. So this feminist sociology, Rita Segato, she speaks of a pedagogy of cruelty that is developing. The pedagogy of cruelty in the sense that the violence itself takes new forms. Not only women who are struggling have been killed, but their body are being left in public spaces. In other words, it's a violence that does not try to hide itself, but makes itself visible, wants to make itself visible, to send a message, to spread terror, to instill fear. And again, so that resistance, people will not engage in resistance. And again, in this article, I look at other situations too, right? All connected with the new form of capitalism, all connected with the expansion of capitalist relation, the new forms of work. For instance, the fact that now more and more across the world, women, because of the general impoverishment of their community, have to find themselves working in conditions that, and in places, where they're much more exposed, they're much more vulnerable to violence. For instance, more and more out in the street, more and more, for example, in places where they have to confront the police, where they have to confront competition, for example, from other vendors, people who want to occupy the urban space, etc. All migration, as we know, right, migration puts you in front of a tremendous amount of violence. And even before the Trump and the walls and the militarization of the border, even before that, you know, women who left Latin America to migrate to the United States would take contraceptives 2 weeks before because they expected to be raped, you know, if not by the coyote who helped them to cross the border, but the police at the frontier. So I think that we need to really, in a sense, see. I think it's important because much attention has been given also with the Me Movement, Me Too movement, to the question of violence and sexual abuse, right, as an abuse of power. Yeah, it's abuse of power, but whose power, right? And I think we have to be careful not to translate all this violence into the bad behavior of a number of men. We have to see that, in fact, this violence, it's really structural in all its form, from the sexual, the smallest sexual abuse to the murder, to the body that is left in the street. We have to see that that violence is a very structural requirement of the new forms of capitalist accumulation. That more and more they're placed on displacement, dispossession, the destruction of the means of reproduction that people have, the destruction of the means of reproduction. When you are out and sponsor legislation, you know, sponsor politics that are destined to impoverish millions of people, they are destined to deprive them of the minimal guarantees that they have for their life, for their survival. You have to have violence. You have to have violence. And it's not an accident that I said before that this violence now is targeting not only women, certainly not only, but certainly is targeting women in new ways, in new, more extended and more brutal ways that it can only be understood, you know, when we connect it with the social economic changes that are taking place. And to finish talking about this book, one of the themes also that I make through and through this discussion, two themes. One is that, you know, at the roots, at the bottom, the violence is always institutional, whether it is the paramilitary or the army or domestic violence as well. But in the end, you know, the violence comes from the institution, either through the impunity, the practice of impunity. For example, very rarely are the witch hunts that are taking place in many parts of Africa or India or Papua New Guinea, they are really investigated, or they are measures taken to prevent them. Very rarely this is the case. Or institutional also, because the policy, the economic and social policies that states are implementing or legitimizing, right, require that violence. And because, you know, the state themselves, you know, are introducing, you know, new policies that are equivalent of witch hunts. And I want to say something here that is not dealt with in the book, but certainly is very important to mention, because it affects the life of thousands and thousands of women, particularly here in the United States. Like, we're seeing now new witch hunts, particularly against women in this country who have very little resources, and women have been racialized. They are object of racism, black women, migrant women, Latino women, who, as one national health advocate has stated, and I quote her, and she's in print, you know, if they become pregnant, if they decide to have a child, they place themselves outside of their constitution, meaning that they can be made the object of so many crimes that no other person would be accused of. For example, now in the United States, I don't know how many people know, right? There are women who have been arrested, they are in jail, for having been in an accident when they were pregnant, in a car accident. And they were accused almost of manslaughter, having placed the fetus at risk. This is because several states are introducing bills that are giving rights of personhood to the fetus. And the more rights the fetuses are gaining, apparently in some trials against women, the fetuses are given a lawyer. The fetus has a lawyer. And the more the fetus gain rights, the least the women. Yeah, it's inversely proportional. So you can be now arrested in this country for taking medicine, legal medicine, that it may have a negative effect on the child that you're carrying. And more worrisome of all is that there is now an attempt in various states, and this is documented, is an attempt by the police to create a cooperation with doctors and nurses in the hospital so that they teach them, for example, how to conduct blood tests in a way they can be more easily used in a courtroom. And two, they are bound, they are being forced to call the police, report to the police, to the authorities, anything that they see abnormal, for instance, in the blood tests or in the care they give to women who are pregnant, right? So there's now this, and of course, the doctors will comply. Many of them, some will rebel, but many will comply because they will be afraid of losing their license, right? So this is a very worrisome new term that is defended as a defense of life. I think it's an attack on women's becoming pregnant, you know, indirect attack, but it's very important that we become aware of that. So there are forms of witch hunts that do not use the name of witchcraft, but actually they are, you know, equally violent in their implication, because I imagine that now more and more, you know, what woman will want to go to have a blood test or to a hospital if upon having a blood test she has to fear that the police will show up at the whole doorstep. Clearly this will not affect all women. It will affect women, particularly categories of women, particular categories of women. But this is happening now already in the country, and I call this is a witch hunt, right? And last is that the importance of seeing that these wars against women, this new war connected with the new forms of capitalist accumulation, it's also a response to the struggle that women are making. It's also a response to the increasing assertion by women of autonomy, of a demand of autonomy, a refusal of social subordination, and as I was saying before, the defense of the territory, the defense of what the community has, and what the community has gained, and which, however, is now costing them, many of them, their life. And so we have to keep that in mind, because we have to join the struggle to make sure that this stops happening. Now, my other book, The Enchanting the World, it's in a way a continuation of the witch hunting witches and women in some ways, right? Because it begins again with the theme of capitalist expansion, primitive accumulation. The first section looks at the different strategies that in different parts of the world over the last 3 or 4 decades, you know, capitalism has used to regain the upper hand, because I see globalization as a political response, you know, to the struggle, the cycle of struggles of the 60s and 70s. Remember, right? The 60s and 70s, when we look back now, looks like a revolutionary period. The anti-colonial struggle across the world, right? The struggle of students the struggle of industrial workers against the regimentation of factory life, the women's movement, right? And it was a crescendo struggle that really undermined some of the most important mechanisms and hierarchy, many of the racial hierarchy, the civil rights movement, black power movement, undermined the hierarchies and mechanism of control that capitalism has set up for 5 centuries. And, the decision at the highest level of capitalist power to transform the global economy, with globalization, neoliberalism, call it as we want, has not been accidental. It's been an attempt to recuperate that command over the process of exploitation. And what do the capitalists do when they are in crisis? The first thing they do is they expropriate people. Violence is always the first step. You use the violence to destroy what people have, what people relied upon, so that you can make them more vulnerable. You force them to accept what comes along, whatever forms of exploitation, because they don't have other means of subsistence. And this is why we have seen, as a result of globalization, we've seen this massive migratory movement. So vast that today the face of the worker is the face of a migrant or the face of a refugee. Less and less people are able to survive and to draw their sustenance from the places in which they live and once they worked. So this implies, again, a tremendous amount of, displacement and so on. But what I do in Reenchanting the World is to look at the response, particularly from below, that is coming in many communities, and how many communities often, after being dispossessed, recreate new forms of life. This is not to idealize or romanticize, but is to actually, reckon with the fact that despite the immense display of violence that the capitalist class has organized across the world, people, many have been able not only to survive, but also create new community. And in my view, and not only in my view, create new forms of reproduction that are, in a way, very inspiring, because they demonstrate a capacity for solidarity. They demonstrate the capacity to reconstruct the social fabric even in the face of a massive attack. And again, I see the role of women here as particularly important. So I have several articles in the second part of Reenchanting the World. I have several articles that look at women in Africa, women in Latin America, and how basically, very often it's been those who have been dispossessed, pushed from the rural area into the urban setting, right, who have created these new forms, new communities, new forms of life. And this is the theme of the commons, the rebuilding of the commons, the commoning of reproductive activities. So I look at the examples, in particularly in the south of the American continent, beginning with the 70s, actually, with what happened in Chile after the Pinochet coup, when women began, they were the first ones who dared to go out into the street and come together at a time when 2 men together would be arrested and disappeared. But they, counting on the machismo of the police, who obviously when they saw women with children walking in the street with children, they thought, oh, these are innocuous people, right? They'll begin to go out, shop together, cook together, bring the pots into the street. They created the sewing groups and embroidering groups. You know, the famous story of the Arpilleras, I don't know if you read, it's an amazing story. The Arpilleras were women who had created these embroidering groups, and why they embroider were the, you know, what the military was doing, right? The torture, the tanks, and very often they were able to send abroad, you know, through these pieces of work, right, the news of what was actually happening inside the country. And not only that in Chile, but later in Argentina, the same phenomenon took place in 2000 when the monetary economy collapsed, and then, as a woman put it, another economy emerged. When the monetary economy collapsed, another emerged, and it was a woman's economy. It was the women again bringing the pot, you know, and cooking and taking care of the children, setting up forms of barter, exchanging things, making sure that life goes on, making sure that despite everything, life goes on. And the beginning to also to create a decision-making process that was communitarian, the famous, you know, neighborhood assemblies, right, where you basically decide collectively, where reproduction becomes a continuous political issue. Where in situation in which life is at the edge of survival, at the edge of danger, and then the question of reproduction, you know, becomes completely political. And in that there's incredible novelty, right? And so these new forms of assembly, assembly-like decision-making. And this has continued and has created forms that now are quite widespread, and you can see, you know, in many of the so-called slums of Latin America, particularly Argentina. You know, I polemicize with Mike Davis when he speaks of a planet of slums. I say better call it a planet of commons, because in many of the slums you see so many new communitarian forms of reproduction. Now the public kitchen has become an institution. Las Olas Comunes now in many places where you find people that, mostly women but also young men, on a rotating basis, they are cooking for hundreds and hundreds of people on a rotating basis, not always the same people, not always the same women, not always, certainly not in isolation, but always collectively. You know, then you have the merenderos to guarantee children, you know, a snack or a glass of milk. You know, you have urban farming, the new phenomenon of urban farming. Some people say that in many African cities, the division, the historic division between city, urban life, and rural life is collapsing, because there's so much urban farming that division is beginning to vanish. And you know, urban gardening, well, we know here, you know, there were no urban garden in the United States, but except for the Victory Garden during World War II. Very important, very important. Too bad that they ended at the end of World War II. But in the 70s and 80s, when the urban gardens come back, they are really being brought by immigrants, either from the American South or from the Caribbean island or from Latin America, right? Because people know that having a piece of land, being able, contrary to the World Bank, having a piece of land, being able to sow something, you know, not only give you some control on what you're eating, but gives you some independence from the market. Gives you some autonomy, the beginning of constructing an autonomy from the market and from the logic of the market and monetary relation, right? So I look at that, and I look in particular at examples that come from some of the regions in Argentina today, you know, where you have really a network of women in situations where there's basically no presence of the state, except as police and military, but no presence in terms of services, of nothing, right? that you have a network of women who are, in fact, taking the responsibility, right, for the reproduction of the community in many ways, whether it is health, whether it is trash, whether it is ensuring these people, even those who have least, have at least 1 meal a day, or taking the kids to school so they don't get run over by the cars because there's no cross light, etc., etc. In addition to doing political formation, setting up musical groups, etc. So what is happening in this process that I find particularly important, and that's what I'm looking at, is that not only there are new forms and initiatives to guarantee people's survival in very difficult conditions, but also the creation of really new forms of cooperation, the creation of new forms of reproduction that really begin to construct construct something very different from the way capitalism has organized reproduction in the past, right? Which has always been totally in a way that fragments people, isolate them in their own individual home, and certainly isolate women, which is one of the reasons, by the way, also housework has become so painful. It's not only the lack of resources, bad houses, et cetera, but also that isolation. The same activity, when you do it collectively, is a very different activity than when you do it alone, particularly day after day after day. So there's a whole new forms of cooperation that is taking place that is very important on so many levels that I'm really trying myself to understand more. And the more I think of it, the more I'm impressed by what is being created. Because as I said, it's not only physical survival, but the solidarity, new capacity of resistance, because in the process, there is a knowledge of the community that is gained, of what the needs are, of what the forces that are preventing those needs from being satisfied are. So there is a knowledge and there is, a capacity to confront the state, to confront the state that it's much heightened because people are reconstructing the social fabric of their communities. And so I look at that and I'm very interested also to rethink what is happening in the United States, because I imagine that something similar is also happening in many communities here. I think in Latin America is particularly strong because of the impact in Latin America, which is stronger, much, much stronger than here, of the still existing indigenous communitarian world, the indigenous communitarian world that has a very, very big impact, I think, on everybody understanding that there is an alternative, the other way. That even if this communitarian indigenous world today is not what it used to be, or is not necessarily the model of existence that one wants to embrace, but nevertheless, it indicates there is another way of living. It indicates that people can construct their life on the basis of collective work, on the basis of collective decision-making, on the basis of solidarity. And this is very, very important today when everything that capitalism is doing is trying to tear us apart. And so much of the dispossession is possible precisely because of that tearing apart, right? So I look at that with in mind precisely, the idea of, where are we going, right? What is the path? And I think it's a path in which women have a particularly important role, because I think that much more than men, women have learned not to separate the moments of struggle from the moment of reproduction. And they've learned to say that you cannot struggle without at the same time changing your reproduction. That in order to struggle over a long period of time and effectively, and not having only moment of great mobilization and then a long silence, yeah, you need to build an infrastructure, a day-to-day infrastructure made of relations among people, made of forms of reproductive work, the children, the cooking, the food, the land, etc., etc. And this, to me, is extremely inspirational, right? And not necessarily because I think that what is being now done in the favelas or the villa of Argentina can be transported everywhere, but because it really shows that another world is possible. Thank you very much.
That's it for Africa World Now Project for this week. I would like to thank you for joining us today and look forward to spending time with you next week. We can be reached through all your regular social media platforms. Email africaworldnowproject@gmail.com or follow us on Twitter at AFWRLDNWPRJ. I'm your host and producer, James Pope. The Africa World Now Project Collective consists of international media journalist, executive producer, and human rights activist, Moise Mutale, Africa World Now Project media correspondent, Funda Ngunda, senior research, content contributor, and production director, Dr. Tasneem Siddiqui, senior researcher and content contributor and production associate, Dr. Josh Myers, associate producer and content contributor, Dr. Keisha Khan Perry, technology advisor is Byron Gray of GrayWorks Technology, and creative director is Judah Pope. Africa World Now Project is heard every Wednesday at 7 p.m. on WSNC, NPR affiliate and broadcasting service of Winston-Salem State University. Shows are archived weekly on SoundCloud. Search Africa World Now Project. Until next week, be safe, be peaceful, and above all, be intelligent.